On a Monday, we're looking at access to school lunches in Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The National School Lunch Program gives kids healthy, affordable school lunches. And if it weren't for this program, families might not be able to afford these meals. It's been running since the 1940s. One assumption about this program is that it's used mostly in urban areas. But here in Wisconsin, there's a big need in rural areas just the same. Sarah Kemp is a researcher focused on school enrollment projections at the University of Wisconsin Applied Population Laboratory. She spoke with WPR host Keely Boltina about her latest piece published by our colleagues at WisConText. It's called A Season of Hunger for Many Wisconsin Kids.
About free and reduced lunches by helping us understand the program. This is administered through schools. Tell us a little bit about it.
So the free and reduced lunch program, which is called the National School Lunch Program, is a federal program that is administrated through the state agency, the Department of Public Instruction.
You mapped where children receive free and reduced lunch prices across the state. Tell us what you found.
So we looked at the free and reduced lunch program eligibility. School district submits the eligibility information to the state. And so we looked at it across the state, and we use a classification of dividing districts between urban, suburban, town, and rural. And so we looked at the differences between those areas of the state. In general, we see more use of this program in rural areas and urban areas than we do in other parts of the states, especially in the central and southeast part of the state.
And so we're talking more the extreme city, the extreme rural areas, as opposed to smaller towns, medium-sized communities.
That's correct, yes.
And why are the child poverty rates in these areas so much different?
Well, I'm not sure I can really address why they are. It's just we have higher child poverty in urban areas and in rural areas. Children in the cities, we currently have about 20% of children living under the poverty level. And in rural areas, in the more rural districts, it's 15%. As compared to the towns, the town districts are at 13%, and the suburban districts are only at 8% in terms of children living under the poverty level. So, I can't really address why that is. It's just that is what we see in a geographic pattern in the state.
When you look at those poverty rates in those areas, the poverty rates are lower than the number of kids approved for free and reduced lunches. How does that work?
So even though we see a poverty level that is lower, when we look at the federal classification of poverty, the free and reduced lunch program actually allows that number to be larger. We see a much larger eligibility for free and reduced lunch than looking directly at the poverty level of children, because it's a way in which they provide. It's the way the program is designed is that there is a percentage of students that are eligible based on a higher level of, so they look at the poverty level of households, and if you are 135% below that level, then you're eligible for a free lunch. And if you are anywhere between 130% and 185%, you're eligible for a reduced price lunch. So it's just a different way of classifying and providing this program to reach out to more students, more children than just those that are under the poverty level.
Sarah Kemp is a researcher with the School Enrollment Projections Program at the University of Wisconsin's Applied Population Laboratory. And we're talking about what free and reduced lunch numbers can tell us about disparities across Wisconsin. Sarah, I want to step back. Let's talk about some basics. Help us again. Who is eligible for those free and reduced price lunches in general? We just talked about the range, but what kind of kids? Where are they?
So the children that all children are eligible for the program if they fall under this guideline that is provided by the federal government. So the students that are eligible for free and reduced lunch are across the state in every district, and there is also some districts that even are eligible for a community eligibility provision that allows the entire district to participate in the program. But otherwise, it's a program that if you fall under this classification of eligibility, you apply to the district that you live in, and that application then provides that program this program to you.
Yeah, and what do the numbers look like? How much is the free and reduced lunch program used in Wisconsin?
So if we go back to this, looking at it based on these classifications, these regional classifications, we have 57% of urban students participating in the program as of last year. Our next category down, highest percentage is 42%, and those are the rural districts, followed by the town districts at 40%. And then the one last group of suburban students participate the least at 24%.
Do we know what the trend looks like? Are more kids needing free and reduced lunches? I mean, this program's been around since the 40s.
Correct, yeah. So the program started in 1946. We have a chart that's on the essay in WisContext, and we looked back at the turn of the century in 2000. And if we look at from 2000 going forward, it did increase each year steadily up until 2014, and we really did see a bump up in the use of the program during the Great Recession. But since 2014, it's leveled off, and we're looking at about 44% of an eligibility rate over the last 5 years since 2014.
How should we think about work against poverty? Are policymakers focusing enough on access to, in this case, school lunches?
I think so. I think there is an awareness of how important it is, and I think it is something that is always a part of a discussion. There's another article that's on WisContext just talking about the program in general and the history of this program and how valuable it has been.
Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And that was WPR's Keely Baltina talking with Sarah Kemp, a researcher at the UW Applied Population Lab who focuses on school enrollment projections modeling. You can read the article about access to low-cost school lunches in Wisconsin and see the maps. It is at wiscontext.org. Be sure to stay with us after 9 on Point. Deadly shooting attacks in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, are causing those two communities to grieve and focus national attention once more on gun policy and questions of domestic terrorism. On Point will have the latest after 9, continuing as well on 1A. Just ahead, solar developments are moving forward in Wisconsin with recent regulatory changes for a pair of utility companies in Madison. We find out what these solar gardens mean for customers. And you can bring your questions about rooftop solar, 800-642-1234. Do you see solar farms in your community? What do you want to know about where this energy goes and how utilities are involved? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. We're talking about solar here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Community solar projects are also called solar farms or solar gardens, and more cities are getting on board. Our neighbors in Minnesota lead the nation with more than one-third of our country's solar gardens. And customers there pay a monthly fee for the solar power, which is blended with the electricity generated by their local utility. Wisconsin, moving in that direction, especially with utilities in Madison. Do you have solar panels on your home or workplace? Tell us about your experience. Is a solar farm coming to your community? Do you support it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Chris Hubbock covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. He's been following the solar industry in Wisconsin. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So we're seeing solar expanding in a few different directions. Can you tell us about the large-scale utility solar projects happening in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this is something that we're seeing a pretty dramatic change in a fairly short period of time. Earlier this year, the Public Service Commission approved two large-scale projects, one in southwest Wisconsin that's going to be about 300 megawatts, and one in northeast that would be about 150 megawatts. Each of these will end up being owned by a couple of utilities. And the scale is pretty dramatic. If you consider that Wisconsin now has maybe a little more than 100 megawatts of solar total in the state, and now we're going to be adding 450. There's another three of these large scale projects in the queue that are sort of in different stages of the permitting process, and then there's even more behind that in the long range queue.
So where will the energy that's generated at these farms, where will it go?
It will go into the grid. These are power plants. They make energy from the sun, as opposed to coal or natural gas or something else. But essentially, it's energy that's going into the grid to power everyone's homes and businesses and everything else we use electricity for.
And so We Energies is one of the parties involved, Madison Gas and Electric as well. What utilities are in this?
Primarily right now it's Madison Gas and Electric and We Energies, as well as one of their subsidiary, Wisconsin Public Service Corp, which serves customers up in the Green Bay area. Those three utilities will own all of these two approved projects so far.
Oh, so they own all the solar panels as well?
They will. It was sort of a two-step permitting process where private developers got approval to build them, and then the utilities got permission to buy them. So it will sort of be private company will build it and then turn it over to the utility, and they will own it and operate it.
We're getting up to speed on large-scale solar projects here in Wisconsin with Chris Hubbock. He covers energy and the environment for the Wisconsin State Journal. You have a line, 800-642-1234. Do you participate in a shared solar program with your public utility? What are the pros and cons? What questions do you have about solar energy? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Chris, what are the drawbacks, in their opinion, of having a large solar farm in a community? What are community members saying?
There's a variety of responses. There was some fairly strong opposition in Iowa County to this project called Badger Hollow. Some neighbors who felt that it was going to be a really dramatic change of the rural landscape, which is, it's farm country now, and this is going to look very different. There's some concerns about taking good farmland out of production. It's not a permanent change, but these are projects that have 50-year leases, so you're talking about a couple generations where this land won't be able to, to be used in the same way that it's used now. People nervous about living near this. On the other hand, landowners who are leasing their land, this is a great deal. They're getting, in some cases, seven times as much money as they could get renting it out for farmland. A lot of farmers are retiring or looking to get out. This is a good way to reap some income off their land.
Do we know if there are more of these large-scale projects in the works?
There are three more that are now in the permitting process, and with the Public Service Commission has applications that they're reviewing, and that's for all together those three would be like another 450 megawatts.
Okay.
And then if you look in the projects being studied, there's about 6,000 megawatts of solar projects being studied. Now, not all of those get built, but that gives you some indication of the dramatic change. And just for comparison, 6,000 megawatts is about the same capacity right now that Wisconsin has in coal plants.
Okay. Can you step back for us and tell us about the shared solar projects that are out there? How does shared solar power work?
Yeah, so the utilities are really doing a couple of different things right now. They're pursuing these large scale solar projects, but then they're also doing a lot of some each in their own way different customer facing projects. Some have shared solar or community solar, sometimes it's called. This is where the utility might put in a solar farm or a smaller scale, they might call it a solar garden, but something on a somewhat smaller scale, but still larger than you could put on your roof. And then they offer it to customers to buy in. In some cases, with XL Energies, you sort of pay up front and you buy a certain number of solar panels, and then the utility pays you for the energy that they generate. You essentially own a little power plant, and each month on your bill you get credit. MG&E structured theirs a little differently. There's a very low cost to buy in. There's a sort of a nominal fee to get in, but then you still pay for your energy, but you get it at a lower rate, and it's fixed for 25 years. So you get a little bit of a hedge against inflation over the years. MG&E, Alliant, each have these. We Energies has a similar one that's for businesses, but this really allows people who maybe don't have space on their roof, they don't have just a good location.
Or maybe they rent.
Exactly. They might be renters. It's just not possible for them to invest in their own solar panels, but they can get part of this cheap energy.
So is this what we're seeing at the Middleton Airport? Is that an example of shared solar?
Yeah, that is one that MG&E has. They have some solar panels that they've put up on a Middleton city building, and now they're going to be doing a 5 megawatt solar farm at the airport. Some of that they've leased out to large customers, big chunks like to the city of Middleton or to the school district. And then the rest is available in very small chunks for regular folks. I think you can subscribe up to about half of your usage if you're just a regular household.
So XL allows the customer to buy a part of the panel. What is the cost benefit for the consumer in this case?
Their calculations show, a lot. There's some variables, but they projected that most people would see their investment paid off in 15 to 17 years. And then going forward, you would actually be in the black. You would make money off this.
So you see that it is an investment up front, but on the long term, it could really pay off for the customer.
It could, yeah.
We're talking solar panels and the policies that we're seeing from Wisconsin regulators as communities install solar gardens, as they install rooftop solar panels. Chris Hubick is a journalist for the Wisconsin State Journal, where he covers energy and transportation. Do you have solar panels on your home, perhaps at your workplace? Tell us about your experience. Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your questions about solar? Where do you see it expanding in your community? Coming up, we break down the cost of solar panels and how that is recouped. We'll be back with that after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the status of community solar power in Wisconsin. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Solar energy is widely considered an essential part of addressing climate change, but many utilities across the country have fought homeowners' efforts to install solar panels. And there's disagreement at the state level. A solar company in Iowa is suing Wisconsin utility regulators that have blocked it from installing solar panels in Milwaukee. It's one of the sticking points as we look at solar. Is a solar farm coming to your community? Do you support it? Do you participate in a shared solar program with your public utility? And what are the pros and cons? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Chris Hubick stays with us. He's a journalist for the Wisconsin State Journal, where he covers energy. Let's go to the phones now with Eric joining us from Baraboo. Hi, Eric. What's your experience with solar?
Yeah, so we have a shared program with Alliant Energy, and we have a 10.1 kilowatt solar system on our home, and they give us a credit of like 7 cents on the dollar, and in the summer months, we get the credit builds up to, you know, $60 or $80, and so, you know, that gets used up every in the winter months. And but still, over the course of the year, our solar system only we only pay like $1,200 over the course of the entire year for our utility. So we look at it as, you know, it's a 30-year mortgage for our home. It's not instant gratification, but over the 30-year timeline, we're going to be saving really a lot of money. And I just wanted to say as a comment, it would be a better system if we had like a battery bank to use up first before getting credit, because the energy companies, it's their grid. I get that, but 7 cents on the dollar is pretty low. It would be a lot nicer to get at least like 25 cents on the dollar. But, you know, that's just where I stand on the subject. And I hope more people get solar, because it's more about saving money than it is to me about being environmentally conscious, even though it is green and everything else.
Eric, may I ask before we go back to Chris, what was your upfront cost? What did your upfront cost look like?
Yeah, so we bought the house with the solar already on it, and it was like a $50,000 system from what we're told. The panels that we have, though, have a 30-year warranty, and so it was only a 3-year-old home, so there was 27 years left on the warranty.
Well, Eric, thank you for the call. And Chris, what are your thoughts there? Eric saying, I wish he had a battery bank.
Yeah, I think that in the years to come, and when I say years to come, I mean just in the next few years, batteries are going to be kind of a game changer. One of the solar energy, I guess the big problem with it is that it's intermittent. It's dependent on the sun, and the sun goes down at night. There are cloudy days where you can't, you know, you're not going to get the same output from your panels. And, you know, we've become accustomed to having electricity on demand 24/7. Having, you know, a system coupled with a battery provides a lot more independence, where you're not reliant necessarily on your utility to provide energy from the grid when your panels aren't producing. So that could allow people to either decouple from the grid or just become a lot less dependent on it. It would almost become a backup, and they could primarily rely on their own systems. And, you know, like Eric said, there's, you know, the utilities are not necessarily paying top dollar for the power that they're buying back from customers. There's arguments to be made on both sides as to, you know, whether what price they should pay. But, you know, that is a factor for people who've made the investment in their own solar panels, is, you know, the payback and what, you know, at times of the day when they're generating way more energy than they can use, what do they do with it? You know, who do they sell it to?
We're getting an update on where the solar industry stands in Wisconsin. Chris Hubick is a journalist for the Wisconsin State Journal, follows trends in solar. Your thoughts on it at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about solar energy? Do you have solar at your home or work? What do you think of it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jim now in Menominee. Hi, Jim. What's your situation on solar?
Well, we have enough solar at our home to cover most of our year-round use. Most months we only pay the basic connection charge. We first put on our first solar panels. We installed those in 1982. We were living in an off-grid house with a wind generator to provide our electricity, and solar panels were a great addition to that. We have since moved and added more solar panels. The original ones are still working fine.
So you've got more than 30 years on your solar, and you still say, you know, the panels are in good shape. You know, technology has changed.
Yeah, I suspect the newer ones that we've installed in the last 20 years will probably last as long or longer. They have made some improvements in how they're manufactured. We not only take care of all of our household uses, we did buy an electric car that we do 95% of our driving with, and that's all charged from the sun.
Oh, wow. So you've really moved in that renewable direction. Chris, what are your thoughts here?
Well, I would say Jim is definitely an early adopter. You know, the big change, I think, you know, in the technology, probably from those early systems to even from 5 years ago to today, is just price. Prices have come down so low that you know, really, if you look at the cost, the overall lifetime cost per megawatt hour or per kilowatt hour of electricity, solar is, in almost every case, comes out the cheapest.
Madison Gas and Electric has made this a net zero by 2050 goal. How does solar fit into that goal?
It's a big part of it. You know, they and for Xcel Energy as well. All the large utilities in Wisconsin, the large investor-owned utilities, have some sort of carbon reduction, whether it's 80% or, like MG&E and Xcel, it's 100%. That's going to depend a lot on solar and a lot on wind. Those are the two primary generating technologies. Then the other piece is going to be batteries to find a way to smooth that curve and fill in the gaps right now that are being filled by coal and natural gas. You know, there's those carbon reduction programs are driven in part by pressure from shareholders, pressure from customers, as well as profit motives. You know, utilities make their profit by building stuff. That's where they get their returns on investment. But it can be, you know, XL Energy has what calls it steel for fuel. So they put steel in the ground and they make a profit on that. But there's no fuel costs. They're not having to buy coal or natural gas. And so they're saying that in the end, their customers save money, that they make money and their customers save money.
Well, homeowners like Jim and businesses have been investing in solar panels for decades now, but they can be expensive. Can you help us understand how costs have come down for consumers?
If costs over the last half century of that the technology has been around, you know, the cost curve just plunges to the point now that you can get rooftop solar for residential for around as low as $2.50 per watt. And this just, you know, for most folks, if you wanted to put in a system that would offset all your use, would mean maybe $15,000 up front, which is a lot of money. That payback can be a lot sooner than it would be, even 10 years ago. There's also new options for financing. And when you combine it with some of the incentives available, the tax credits and other rebates, it can make the economics quite friendly.
Are tax credits still pretty robust in this area, or are they tapered off?
The federal tax credit is right now for 2019 is still 30%. And the current bill starts to phase down next year to 26 and then 22. And then it finally comes down to 10% in perpetuity. There's a bill in Congress right now that would extend the 30% credit. That seems to have support, kind of bipartisan support, but we'll see where that goes. But for right now, I think that's one reason that you're seeing a lot of moves to get projects started. If they can get work started in 2019, they can qualify for that 30% credit. And that applies to both utility scale projects and consumer like residential rooftop.
Talking solar energy with Chris Hubick. He is a reporter covering energy for the Wisconsin State Journal. What do you think about Wisconsin's approach to solar power? What actions do you want out of state utility regulators when it comes to solar? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation on solar in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about community solar in Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are 43 states with at least one community solar project online. That's according to the Solar Energy Initiatives Association. It has other numbers on Wisconsin. We rank 37th in the nation with about 10,000 homes powered by solar energy. What questions do you have about solar? Do you have solar at your home or work? What do you think about it? 800-642-1234. Chris Hubick stays with us. He covers the industry as a reporter at the Wisconsin State Journal. Let's go back to the phones now with Eric joining us from DeSoto. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So what do you think about solar?
I like solar thermal. I think solar thermal makes sense for Wisconsin. I think photovoltaic does not. And the reason why is because other than extreme distributed power situations where the solar panels are sited somewhere distant from any power sources where it's reducing line losses, solar photovoltaic solar panels actually increase Wisconsin's carbon footprint. And the reason that they do is because the monocrystalline structures are sensitive to thermal extremes. It creates actually a physical shock to the cells to go from extreme cold to extreme hot. They don't last as long. And then also it uses more power to create, ship, and install photovoltaic panels than they return in their lifetime in Wisconsin. For that reason, coupled with the reality that Wisconsin does not have that good of a solar resource.
Eric, thanks so much for the call. Chris, what about solar thermal?
I guess we're talking about just heating water for household use. That's something I haven't studied in depth. There have been, those type systems. Passive solar heat has been around for a long time.
So how does Wisconsin's solar landscape compare to our neighboring states? I was taking a look at Minnesota's data compared to Wisconsin, and Minnesota has a lot bigger investment, it looks like, in solar.
Yeah, particularly when we talk about community solar, Minnesota has been a leader in that. I think they have something 585, I believe, megawatts of community solar gardens installed, which is just dwarfs what we have here in Wisconsin. We're catching up more in terms of the large utility owned versus the community model.
What do you think is behind that? Is it about regulation? Is it about utilities, in their mission, what they want to do? Where do you see the motivation in what's happening in Minnesota?
Minnesota's was driven by legislation. That was something that their government laid out as a program that would be beneficial. Wisconsin hasn't, though utility regulators have been supportive of the programs that have been brought to them. So when the utilities have proposed it, I think in every case they've been approved.
So two of Wisconsin's tribal nations recently were awarded federal grants for renewable energy projects. How big of an impact with this would have on Wisconsin's solar output?
For those particular projects, those are pretty small in terms of impact on the overall state, but their impact for those tribes, is quite big. These are ways to offset a lot of their energy costs.
Chris, before we have to let you go, what are you watching for here as Wisconsin moves towards solar? It looks like.
I think the story that's most at the forefront right now is this sort of struggle over what's sometimes called third-party solar, that has to do with creative ways of financing solar. And it's one that the utilities have really fought and said, only a utility or a customer can own the panels, can own a generator. This could be a game changer in terms of how solar moves forward.
Chris Hubick is a data journalist for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he covers energy. He's been following the solar industry in Wisconsin. Now, for many kids, summer camp is a part of growing up. Camps provide adventure and camaraderie. That's solidarity can be especially important for kids who've gone through a traumatic experience. Shemaine Mills reports on a camp for young burn survivors that will take place next week.
Burn scars can fade over time, but memories and friendships linger for those who've gone to Camp Timberley. On Tanya Bolchin's refrigerator is a picture of a camp buddy's new baby. Bolchin also has a photo album full of friends she met at camp, stored safely in her Middleton home.
We had the flooding and then recarpeting and everything last fall, so they were buried somewhere, so I spent a chunk of time trying to find them, but I did eventually find it.
The album includes pictures of Bulgin over the years. She started going to the East Troy camp at the tender age of 8.
At the time, I was having trouble staying overnight places, so they're like, okay, if she can't make it, we got people that will drive her home middle of the night. It'll be fine. I think just knowing that, like, I made it the whole first week.
It was a confidence builder for the young girl who had been severely burned in a house fire as an infant and underwent 30 surgeries. But it never stopped her from attending camp every year, even if she was sidelined from some activities because of her injuries.
So over the years, like I, in high school, had several surgeries on my scalp, so I couldn't do some of the activities just because either I couldn't get my head wet or I couldn't put a helmet on.
That's her dog, Otis, who greets newcomers with a fierce bark that fades when the treats come out.
Sit. Good boy.
Bulgin, now 33, has been part of burn camp since it started, first as a participant, now as a counselor.
One of my kids had newer burns, so she had some Job's, the pressure garments still, so we're making sure we cleaned those after the lake and just making sure she had what she needed so she could have a good time at camp.
The camp has horseback riding, rope climbing, archery, and much more. There's plenty to do. This will be the first year cell phones aren't allowed, says another longtime camp counselor, Jimmy Ahn.
That's a big thing now that has changed over the 15 years that I've seen, is just that how kids are always on their devices now. Where at camp, we want them to concentrate on the activities at camp, concentrate on each other, and not be on their devices.
Ahn is a firefighter, one of many volunteers who staffed the free camp, started 25 years ago by the Charitable Foundation for the State Firefighters Union. Jimmy's son Oscar first went to camp at age 10 after he was burned in a kitchen accident.
Burn camp is kind of special. You get to be there to be yourself, you know. You go there every year. It's like your second family.
Now 17, this will be Oscar's last year at camp, but his father plans to continue being a counselor, calling it his most personally rewarding week of the entire year. Camp director and Milwaukee burn nurse Melissa Kirsten agrees.
Working in a burn center, we see people at their worst possible moments many times, and knowing that people get to get better is very rewarding, and being able to watch the children at camp, watch them get better and enjoying life and getting back to their lives is what keeps me going.
In a world where challenges can sometimes seem insurmountable, the camp is a refuge for those who may be suffering from more than burns.
They come from all over the state and different socioeconomic backgrounds where being burned is sometimes not their biggest worry in life. So you really wonder, what will 1 week of a kid's life do? And I've heard this, I don't know how many people, I'm not the person I am today without burn camp.
Counselors reassure kids their injuries do not define them, but the traumatic experience leaves a mark and sometimes creates a path for how they'll live their life. Tanya Bulgin, for instance, spent endless hours of recovery reading books. She's now a librarian, opening up new worlds to others, just like burn camp expanded her horizons. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network.